DW Africa Link.
Hello there, it's time to get the latest news from Africa and around the world. Welcome to Africa Link. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. And as you realize, we have new openers for the show and new jingles that you will like because they've been designed with that African vibe, as you can hear, Eddie. Isn't it interesting?
Definitely. Makes me jiggle in the studio.
You can also join us live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. And don't forget to share comments with us.
Now, coming up on the show, Zimbabwe has sworn in its members of parliament. But what do some Zimbabweans think about it?
If ZANU is in government and MDC has the parliament, we've always had the parliament for years. It doesn't change anything because the government is ZANU-PF.
We are heading nowhere. We need Chamisa. We want him to be the president.
And for the first time since the end of the genocide in Rwanda, opposition parties win seats in parliament, a major milestone for the country's democracy.
Everyone right now, most of the people I've been talking to, think this is something that everyone should be happy about. They think this gives hope to anyone who wants to start a political party.
I think, Eddie, the jingles are really awesome, isn't it?
It's going to be a great show, definitely with this. But Isaac, there's a much more coming up on the show. But before we delve into that, let's hear the news in brief.
I'm Christina Kabal with the DW News. The United Nations Commissioner of Inquiry on Burundi said it had reasonable grounds to believe that the government of that country was committing crimes against humanity. The commission added that President Pierre Nkurunziza was partly to blame because of his repeated calls to hatred and violence. In Geneva today, Françoise Hampson, a member of the commission, described crimes being committed on a regular basis by Burundi's security forces.
Des executions arbitraires. Des arrestations et détentions arbitraires.
Summary executions, arbitrary detention, torture and other cruel and inhuman treatment, sexual violence, violation of civic liberties, and violation of economic and social rights, as well as enforced disappearances.
Violation des droits économiques et sociaux. Disparition forcée aussi.
Cameroon's army on Wednesday said it had killed three people in Bamenda, the capital of the country English-speaking northwest region, after they threatened to attack a senior government official who was visiting the area. Tensions in the region spiked as children returned to school. Separatists say the education system marginalizes English-speaking pupils and have decreed a boycott of schools in the areas they lay claim to. The Democratic Republic of Congo has recorded its first case of Ebola in the eastern trading hub of Butembo, the health ministry said on Wednesday. The city of 1.4 million inhabitants has strong trade links to neighboring Uganda. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed traveled to Eritrea this Wednesday to watch the first arrival in two decades of an Ethiopian commercial ship in the ports of Asab and Massawa. The cargo ship Mekele entered the Red Sea port of Massawa and was due to carry 11,000 tons of Eritrean zinc to China, according to Ethiopian media. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn. More than 200,000 people have fled fighting between the radical Islamic Taliban and government troops in Afghanistan since the beginning of the year. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said today that more than half of the refugees are children. According to the UN, last year the number of displaced people reached 450,000. British prosecutors today charged two Russian men with the nerve agent poisoning of ex-spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in the English city of Salisbury. Prosecutor Sue Hemming said,
"There is sufficient evidence to provide a realistic prospect of a conviction and that it is clearly in the public interest to charge Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Bosharov, who are Russian nationals. We will not be applying to Russia for the extradition of these males, as the Russian constitution does not permit extradition of its own nationals."
Russia responded by reiterating concerns about the lack of evidence to implicate Russian nationals in the near-fatal poisoning of the former double agent. Uganda and Mozambique have the world's smallest share of inactive people, 6% each. This is one of the findings of a global study by the World Health Organization on exercise habits. The report says that more than one in four adults around the world face a higher risk of diseases such as diabetes and cancer because they are not getting enough exercise. In poorer countries, people are more active as work and transport still require more muscle power. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Christina Kripal.
Welcome back to the program. If you just tuned in, this is Africa Link. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. You're also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Ibrahim Barre is there. Can see you. OBED also says hello. And Tochuku Onuku says, good day. Good day to you back. Hassan Conte says he's listening live from the state of Kuwait.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks, indeed. Now, we begin the program in Zimbabwe, where the 9th Parliament and the first under the new leader, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has been sworn in. The Parliament, which comes at the back of tensions between the ruling party and the opposition after the July 30th elections, is faced with a huge task to push for reforms that could turn around the struggling economy.
However, analysts say this will only be put to test if the ruling party, which won the majority, does not abuse its numbers to enact bad laws. DW correspondent Privilege Mushvanri in Harare attended the swearing-in and filed this report.
These Zimbabwean parliamentarians who took oath of office on Wednesday are faced with an uphill task. The nation is looking up to them to help turn around the fortunes of the country. Skeptics are, however, worried that the ruling party may abuse its majority to enact bad laws. Speaking to DW at Parliament Building soon after taking oath, opposition female and youngest parliamentarian, 25-year-old Johanna Mamombe, had this to say.
This 9th Parliament is crucial because it's coming at a point whereby Zimbabwe is facing a difficult moment. The issues to do with corruption, we need to make sure that as Parliament we curb issues to do with corruption. Talk about also the deplorating economic situation in Zimbabwe. So this also lies in the hands of Parliament to make sure that we make Zimbabwe a better place to be.
Some feel that the next government can only do better if there is inclusivity of opposition and ruling party minds. Here is Tendai Biti, an opposition member of Parliament.
You've got the challenge of the paralysis in the economy. ZANU can't run this economy. So the citizen is suffering. So this is a very unfortunate Parliament, which is being set out to fail because of polarized politics.
In separate interviews, opposition and ruling party supporters expressed mixed feelings.
If ZANU is in government and MDC has the parliament, we've always had the parliament for years, it doesn't change anything because the government is ZANU-PF.
We are heading nowhere. We need Chamisa. We want him to be the president.
Now we are saying zero tolerance to corruption. Any minister who has been sworn in, any MP sworn in, must fight corruption. Corruption is dead. Zimbabwe will grow again.
Political analyst Alexander Rosero says the sworn 9th parliament is short of technocrats that may be needed to drive Zimbabwe's future, but its success should not be tied to political parties and personalities.
It's about good governance. It's about solid, strong institutions that are very clear, strong institutions that adhere to the spirit of the constitution and constitutionalism.
That was Privilege Mushvanri.
And now we asked on our Facebook page, how different do you think this cabinet will be from former President Robert Mugabe, the MPs? Wisdom Nancy here in Germany says, Emmerson Mnangagwa is to Zimbabwe what Blaise Compaoré was to Burkina Faso.
Michael Sanjo adds, two sides of the same coin.
Anyway, keep the comments flowing on our Facebook page, DW Africa. And now to take you to a big story of the day that is making headlines around the world, it is Syria. The international community has mounted calls to avoid a bloodbath by regime forces in Syria's last rebel-held province of Idlib. This comes 2 days before a summit in Tehran between key powers backing the government and the opposition.
With about 3 million people living in Idlib, including 1 million children, there are fears of the largest scale humanitarian disaster since the beginning of Syria's 7-year conflict that has killed over 350,000 people and displaced millions. Our correspondent Aisha Alfora in Beirut spoke to DW's Sumi Somskanda in Berlin on what is likely to happen in Idlib and its people.
Well, that's a big question, but we will see an armed confrontation in the province of Idlib. We don't yet know what the scope is going to be, but however small or large it is, there will be civilian casualties because this is a very congested area and where the extremist jihadist group now known as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, where their members are, there are many civilians. So even if Russians and the Syrians say we're attacking just the extremist jihadist group, civilian casualties are bound to happen.
Anshu, remind us why this battle for control of Idlib is so important.
Well, this is the last rebel stronghold, and if Syrian government and Russia does win here, then that means that the Assad government has won the war, and that would mean that there would possibly be no political reconciliation. This is also where all the rebels are. Some of the leading leaders of the rebel groups are in Turkey, in the border areas, but the rebel strength is in this province. So what sort of a reconciliation would come about if the Assad government wins? So in that sense, this would be the final chapter of the 7 to 8 year long Syrian war.
Before an offensive is launched, a flurry of diplomacy is planned for the next few days. Anshul, can a solution be found to limit the destruction of Idlib and the impact on civilians?
To limit, yes, but can a peaceful solution be found? That's next to impossible.
That was Anshul Fora speaking to DW's Sumi Sumaskanda in Berlin.
And back to Africa, that is Rwanda, where the ruling party was set to win 3/4 of directly elected parliamentary seats in this week's poll, though the opposition Greens won seats for the first time, according to provisional results released. Long-term ruler President Paul Kagame's Rwanda Patriotic Front, RPF, and its 7 smaller allied parties had 74% of the votes, equating to 40 seats in parliament, a slight drop on 5 years earlier.
The country's only critical opposition, the Green Party, made a political breakthrough despite the expected dominance of the RPF. The Greens became the first opposition party to enter parliament since the end of the genocide in 1994, according to the results, winning 5% of the vote and 2 seats.
Shortly before we came on air, I spoke to DW's Nasra Bishumba in Kigali, and I started by asking her how the news of critical opposition parties was received in the capital, Kigali.
I think the first reaction was surprise. No one really expected this to be any different from the previous elections, where you had the ruling party RPF with its allies PL and PSD. But when it was announced that two newcomers, who are Democratic Green Party and PS Imbonerakure, had also gotten 2 seats in each in parliament, everyone was very surprised and everyone was excited. Everyone right now, most of the people I've been talking to, think this is something that everyone should be happy about. They think this gives hope to anyone who wants to start a political party. They think this is a good opportunity, even for the government, to show that maybe this is not a rubber stamp parliament as everyone. And mostly everyone is happy for the other political parties because most of them started just recently, not more than 8 years ago. So this is something that most people are really happy about.
Nasra, another record for Rwandan women in parliament has been set after they garnered 67.5%. I mean, this is a major victory and milestone for the women in Rwanda, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But it's also not very surprising for Rwandans because women are almost in every decision-making position in this country. They are heading institutions, they are heading even in private sector. Women are really doing very well. But of course, women will still be very happy to see that the numbers are not going down, that the numbers are actually going up. And there's always something to celebrate, especially in a world where in most countries women are still being oppressed. Women in Rwanda are very proud to be in the position they're in right now.
And how about the youth? Because in recent days we've been reporting how they wanted to take over the parliament from the old guard. Has this been the case? Was it reflected on the vote?
Yes, it was. This morning I was talking to one of the young MPs. Obviously, maybe he's in parliament representing the youth. He's 28 years old. But he was telling me that he thinks that this is an opportunity for the youth to also advance themselves, to also be able to be heard more than they usually are. And most of the voters that I met over the weekend and on Monday when the elections were going on were really young people. They were also first-time voters. And the youth this year and this particular election really participated more than they have in other elections. So this is a plus, yes, for the youth too.
I was speaking to Nasra Bishumba in Kigali. Welcome back to the program. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I am Eddie Micah Jr. We're also live on our Facebook page, TW Africa. And Isaac, I think it's only right that we acknowledge one or two people.
Exactly. Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, our usual contributors, you know, Alex Lutarika. I just saw his message somewhere saying, I'm listening live as usual in Kigali. Mm-hmm. Hassan Conte is also listening. And Lutarika says, it is very unfortunate that the world has failed Syria. That's about the report that he just, listened to about the fate of Idlib. Yeah. Mm. Tell us what you think, what the world can do about Syria afresh.
Exactly. Now, coming up in the next 15 minutes, we'll be hearing from Kenya's waste pickers at one of the dump sites in the capital, Nairobi.
I sift through the garbage because I'm trying to earn a little money. I'm no longer on my own. I have a wife and child now.
Eddie, you can listen to the voice of that young man who has to sift through the garbage to eke out a living. You know, he says he has a wife and a child to take care of.
Definitely not a pleasant situation, Isaac.
And of course, you can tell us how you manage your waste or whether the city council is doing something to clean up the garbage or it is all up to the citizens to take care of it by sifting through, by recycling the material, a work that should be done by the government and city council authorities.
Definitely, Isaac. Now, UN investigators on Wednesday warned that crimes against humanity and other serious rights violations were continuing unabated in Burundi, blaming in part President Pierre Nkurunziza's repeated calls to hatred and violence. According to reports, such crimes were still ongoing, citing summary executions and forced disappearances, arbitrary detention, torture and sexual violence.
Now, Burundi plunged into crisis in 2015 after Nkurunziza sought a fiercely contested third term in office that his opponents said was unconstitutional. Turmoil since then has killed at least 1,200 people and has forced 400,000 to flee their homes and triggered an investigation by the International Criminal Court. Before we came on air, I spoke to Phil Clark, an expert on the Great Lakes region, and I began by asking him why the world has kept silent about what's happening in Burundi. Take a listen.
It's a scandal that the international community has stopped paying attention to what's happening in Burundi. Burundi was in the headlines a couple of years ago, but it's very difficult to keep international attention on the country. Partly it's because Burundi is not of enormous strategic importance internationally, but also this has become a low-level conflict in the minds of international policymakers because we haven't seen explosive outbreaks of violence compared to, say, what's happening in neighbouring Democratic Republic of Congo. There hasn't been a huge amount of attention on this particular case, and I think that's extremely problematic because the violence is still significant in Burundi and human rights violations are continuing on a very large scale.
Does it mean that Burundi has now been isolated by both the regional and international community?
Indeed. Burundi finds itself completely isolated. All of its neighbours in the East African community now see Burundi almost as a pariah state. And we've seen the East African community and the Conference of the Great Lakes countries engaging in shuttle diplomacy over the last couple of years. But the regional powers are very frustrated that those talks have completely stalled and have really had no effect on the conflict.
Now, according to the report, members of the National Intelligence Service, the police and the Imbonerakure, that's the youth wing of the ruling party, including also other high-ranking officials, committed a large number of human rights violations. Will these groups, in your opinion, ever face justice and when?
Accountability seems very unlikely for these Burundian government actors. The International Criminal Court has opened a preliminary investigation into crimes committed in Burundi, but the ICC hasn't been able to get investigators on the ground in the country. And so without that evidence, it's going to be very difficult to mount any kind of international court case.
Now, we know that Burundi tried and failed to stop the UN Commission of Inquiry, which was set up by the UN Human Rights Council in 2016, and until now even refused to cooperate with it. What are some of the repercussions and the consequences of all this, and where does it leave the country itself?
The fact that Burundi has refused the UN investigators reasonable access on the ground has definitely affected the UN's ability to report on this conflict. But, of course, this is violence that has led to nearly 500,000 refugees being pushed into neighbouring countries, particularly Tanzania, Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda. And so the UN has been able to gather an enormous amount of evidence about what's happening inside Burundi through the testimony of those refugees. The big question now is how can any kind of resolution be brought to the political impasse that's still happening inside Burundi? And it's difficult at the moment to see where any sustainable resolution is going to come from.
Phil Clark, an expert and researcher on the Great Lakes region.
But Isaac, you're very right, even with the intro you gave, that it seems that Burundi has been forgotten. I mean, there's a lot happening there, violations going on and all, but no one's really saying anything.
Yeah, it seems so, because even the analyst there, Phil Clark, you had him say, Burundi is not on the menu, on the plate of world problems at the moment. A lot is going on that the international community is concerned about, that is Syria, Turkey, etc. So, I mean, hopefully they get out of it. Anyway, we still have much more to come, so stay with us.
On the spot.
And on the spot this week, imagine you are a motorist traveling on a highway, but you're not allowed to speed or drive beyond, let's say, 40 kilometers per hour, lest the hidden cameras do their work. Not entirely a bad idea, Eddie, is it? But in the absence of traffic signs to show which speed limit you're not supposed to go beyond, it could be a nightmare for so many drivers or motorists.
It definitely could, Isaac. That's the predicament that Zambian motorists have found themselves in after the government issued a directive of no driving beyond 40 kilometers per hour on major highways in the country. The government said this will tame accidents and save lives. But for the motorists, this directive will affect the country's economy. From Lusaka, Kathy Sikombe sent this report.
This is the central business district in the Zambian capital, Lusaka, as motorists hustle and bustle on a busy Wednesday afternoon. But since last month, more than 45,000 motorists have been slapped with overspeeding fines. A Lusaka resident had no kind words for the government.
I'm Wali Anondo.
You cannot be charging people, you know, on overspeeding when you know that, number one, you haven't done your homework. There's need to sensitize people. There's need to put up, you know, signage. All these things were not put in place. And then you just caught up people unaware and begin to find them. First and foremost, there's need to engage stakeholders. And I believe that motorists are the major stakeholders. You need to engage them in a way that they understand.
Because of such concerns, motorists have warned that they will be honking and deliberately drive at a very slow speed until the infamous decisions are revisited. But Fred Mubanga, the spokesperson for the Zambian Road Traffic and Safety Agency, RATSA, says the speed cameras are aimed at reducing the high number of road traffic accidents, which claim more than 3,000 lives annually.
This program has been implemented for almost a month. Started on the 11th of last month. For the first week, we had over 21,000 traffic violations. For the second week, we had over 15,000 traffic violations. For the third week, we had about 9,000 traffic violations, and we'll be compiling for this week. And from the statistics, you could see that each week is having a reduction in traffic violations that has got to do with speed. So it's a good measure going forward. And our aspirations is to see that by the end of the year, these figures should be reduced by maybe even 1,000 traffic violations in a week.
To many Lusaka residents, the latest measures to slow down traffic will affect their income and slow down business. To them, it means that they will have to work twice as hard as before. Ezra Nguluwe, an economic analyst, says while the speed cameras are good, the fines are too high and could hamper economic growth since citizens are already being overtaxed for goods and services delivered.
The salary or the income that an ordinary Zambian is getting, it remains the same, and yet the taxes have been introduced every now and then. An ordinary Zambian will definitely be affected negatively because at the end of the day, our income remains the same and the taxes are coming almost on a daily basis. So it's really going to have a negative impact. And at the end of the day, there is need for government to realize that you cannot develop the country through taxes. You develop the country through manufacturing and adding value to our natural resources that we have.
The latest speed fine comes barely 2 weeks after the government introduced another controversial internet tax on all internet calls.
That was Kathy Sukumbe with that report.
Living Planet Africa.
Yes, indeed. Living Planet Africa. That's the new jingle taking us to an environmental story. Waste disposal is a big problem in Kenya, where official recycling systems are rare. The Kenyan capital, Nairobi, produces nearly 2,000 tons of trash every day, and the sanitation department is overwhelmed. Most of the waste in Nairobi ends up at the Dandora dump site that occupies a massive 30-acre space.
For a country that has been championing green energy solutions, the current state of the Dandora dam site is the embodiment of the impact of environmental neglect of Kenyan lives. Despite the bad side of the dam site, many Kenyans eke their living from the site. DW's Thomas Hassel went to find out.
Garbage covering an area bigger than 30 football fields, just a few kilometres from the centre of Nairobi. Every day, hundreds of trucks haul trash here from the city. The dump is like a big unorganised recycling centre. Some people, like Godwin Ochieng, are here almost every day.
I sift through the garbage because I'm trying to earn a little money. I'm no longer on my own. I have a wife and child now, and they're waiting for me to come home with milk or bread in the evening. I can't go back empty-handed.
The garbage collectors gather up food, plastic, paper and scrap metal, some of which they sell. After a good 8 hours' work, Ochieng brings his finds to a small courtyard to sort. He can convert almost everything he's collected into money.
If I sell these containers today, I might get around 300 to 400 shillings. That's enough to feed my family today and even tomorrow afternoon before I return home after work.
Ochieng's income of $3 or $4 a day lifts him over the international poverty line, set by the World Bank at $1.90. Whether plastic containers, discarded cutlery, or old electric cables that can be sold to auto repair shops in the slums, there's a demand for recycled goods. And that's also true of discarded food. Ochieng feeds pigs, goats, and chickens with it. When the animals are full grown, he sells them to a local slaughterhouse. Since 2003, the government has enacted laws intended to regulate environmentally friendly waste management. But consumers and waste producers don't seem to care. At the edge of the dump, a lively informal trade has sprung up. Ochieng delivers what Kenya's recycling industry needs. Goods and materials are sold by weight. Even the market in the Dandora district profits from the garbage dump. Many reusable products can be found in the stalls. People who live in the slums can buy things here that they wouldn't be able to afford new.
This is a key holder. I get it from dump site. When I went to town last week, I found it 100. But now, I bought it there for only 20 bob. I sell on 30 bob, only 30 bob.
Closing the garbage dump would threaten the survival of many people here. But it's very apparent to Ochieng that a lot more needs to be done to combat poverty in Kenya.
I think those with money should open something like a resource center that could help lift those who have little or help young people facing a tough life. At least that would help reduce poverty in this slum.
Everything needed to set up a large recycling centre is right here, says Godwin Ochieng. Raw materials, manpower and markets. Although Dandora's informal recycling sector ensures an income for many, the massive dump puts a huge strain on the people and the environment.
A report by DW's Thomas Hassel.
Well, that's all time will allow us on this show. Thanks for being a part of it. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe.
Bye for now.